All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I'm your host, Aaron Freeman, and today we're talking about the breaking report of Dirk Koetter being offered the Falcons offensive coordinator position, as well as getting my thoughts on some of the standout players that may be on the Falcons' radar from the national championship game.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
So, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman. I've been covering the Falcons for many years at FalcFans.com, on Twitter at FalcFans. And, of course, I am the host of this illustrious Locked On Falcons podcast. Today, I'm coming at you to give you my thoughts on sort of the breaking news that emerged Monday night during the national title game between Clemson and Alabama, that the Falcons had offered, and I want to stress offered. Nothing is confirmed as I'm recording this shortly after midnight on Tuesday, or technically Tuesday morning, only an hour after the national championship game ended. You know, so maybe when you guys are listening to this Tuesday morning or Tuesday afternoon or whenever, you know, there is a confirmation of a report of that the Falcons have actually hired Dirk Koetter. But I'll talk about that. I'll also talk about some of the players I was focused on watching the national championship game live, some of the prospects on both Clemson and Alabama, focusing exclusively on the players in the trenches, because we know that's going to be the MO of the Falcons offseason, hashtag physicality. In 2014, it was hashtag toughness, but this year it's hashtag physicality. So I'll give you some of my thoughts on those guys later on, but let's talk about the potential hire of Dirk Koetter. For those of you that don't know, this was not the move. This was my least favorite of the candidates. I know other people put forth Mike Mularkey, but I never really thought of Mike Mularkey as a serious contender. And based off of Jason Butt's report of The Athletic, that Mularkey only interviewed for a positional coach, not for the offensive coordinator position. And so, you know, looking at sort of the candidates that were being talked about, whether it's Kubiak or Bevel or Gase or Koetter or whoever else, but literally put anybody else on that list, and I would like that more than Dirk Koetter. And, you know, I feel like the Falcons have been there, done that with Dirk Koetter. And, you know, I have a lot of issues. I could literally spend 20 minutes breaking down all my issues, but I'll sort of limit it to the two biggest complaints I had about the Sark offense was sort of the vanilla route concepts and the lack of explosiveness. And, you know, when I talked about sort of the vanilla nature of the Sark offense and sort of its limited route combinations and not really using route combos to attack various coverages and relying too much on guys' ability to win man coverage, who did I compare that offense to? I compared it to the Koetter offense. When Sark was at his lowest in 2017, I compared that offense to the Dirk Koetter offenses. And that, you know, we all sort of universally agree that those weren't good offenses, at least in the Sark. But, you know, for some reason, we're looking back at those Koetter offenses as if they were great or anything like that. You know, what's interesting is you look at the highest output those Koetter offenses did in 2012. They scored 419 points. This past year, they scored 414 points. And apparently Sark is a terrible offensive coordinator. So, you know, that's something just to think about. But the problem, you know, I'm trying not to go on a 20-minute rant. So I'm just trying to, you know, self-edit myself a little bit here. So let's just talk about the lack of explosiveness. And you go back to those Koetter offenses, and like the Mularkey offenses, one of the biggest issues those teams had was their lack of explosiveness. And this was something I wrote about quite a bit in 2013 and 2014, and talked about sort of one of the reasons why I was optimistic when we hired Dan Quinn in 2015 and Kyle Shanahan was that these guys understood the, you know, how to be explosive with their offenses. And that was one of the reasons why I was optimistic about those guys' ability to turn things around. Then when that didn't quite live up to expectations in 2015, I got very down on that coaching staff. And then, of course, sort of they exploded in 2016. And so basically they did the thing that I thought they would do, or did more than what I thought they would do, certainly in 2016, you know, a year later. So the Koetter offenses, man, like, you know, you go back to those 3 years, they were not very explosive at all. You know, they had reasons in 2013 due to the injuries. 2014 was their most explosive season. In terms of looking at the 20 plus yard plays, they had 68 of those, which was tied for the eighth most in the league that season. But what is interesting is 40% of those plays, 27 to be exact, came in their four combined games against the Bucs and Saints. As you may or may not recall, Julio Jones was very dominant against those two teams that particular season, combining for 31 catches, 503 yards, and two touchdowns in those four games against the Saints and Bucs. You know, roughly half of the team's 20 plus yard plays, those 27 plays against in those four games, 13 of which were by Julio Jones in those games. In fact, 31 out of the team's 68 big plays that season were from Julio Jones. So I don't think it was really the design of the offense that was explosive. I just think it was Julio Jones being Julio effing Jones and doing Julio effing Jones things, pardon my French, that made the offense, at least on paper, look explosive, and particularly against those opponents. You know, you look at outside those four games against the Bucs and Saints, the Falcons averaged about 3.4 big plays per game, 20-plus yard plays, which on a per-game basis would have put the Falcons close to the bottom 10 in the league that season in 2014, and was about what they averaged in 2012 when they were the seventh lowest number of big plays in the season in that 2012 season. Now, again, I know you're sitting there being like, well, it's Mike Smith's fault, and you know, Dirk Cutter's, the talent was different, and Matt Ryan's better, and Dirk Cutter might have improved things in Tampa Bay, but not really. I mean, you look at the three combined seasons where he was calling plays in 2015, 2016, and 2017 in Tampa Bay, the Bucs were the 19th most explosive offense in the league with 177 20-plus yard plays in that three-year span. You know, in that same span, the Falcons had a combined 207-plus big yard plays, which was the second highest in the league behind only the Saints. Again, 177 plays over 48 games is about 3.7 plays per game. And then Cutter relinquishes play calling responsibilities to Todd Monken this past year in Tampa Bay. And guess what? The Bucs go off for 76 big plays this year, which is almost five a game. You know, in comparison to the Falcons had 70 this year. So, you know, you also look at the fact that with Monken calling plays this year, the Bucs saw their scoring output increase 20% this year. So, you know, this idea that, like, oh, like, you know, look, you can certainly, like, Jameis Winston was not a particularly efficient quarterback, you know, in the first 3 years of his career, except for when he played the Falcons for whatever gosh darn reason. But, like, you know, the things that Cutter offenses does, it's an Air Coryell-based offense, which means it's a vertical offense. It loves four verticals. But the way that Cutter used the four verticals concept in Atlanta was basically have the guys run 10 yards to the line of scrimmage, you know, 10 yards to the sticks and turn around and Matt Ryan will throw them football. And that type of offense just doesn't work against good defenses. Good defense is going to be like, we're going to press your receivers at the line of scrimmage. We're going to jam them. We're going to throw off the timing of your offense. If our pass rush is good, which most good defenses have good pass rushes, our guys are going to get there. That's why the Falcons in those Cutter years struggled so much against those Panther defenses in those years, because that's exactly how Carolina would play them, which is like, we'll just jam Julio at the line of scrimmage and our pass rush will dominate your offensive line. And that type of offense is not built to be a high-level offense in the league. So, to me, the Cutter offense, the other issues that Cutter's, you know, obviously his teams in Atlanta weren't great at running the football. They weren't great in Tampa Bay running the football outside of the one healthy season that Doug Martin had. They don't really do zone blocking stuff that all that much. They do a little bit, but, you know, because everybody does a little bit, but that's not sort of the staple of those Cutter offenses. So that's a weird fit as far as the Falcons offense goes. They don't really use play action to a high degree in Tampa Bay. You know, it's one of those things. They didn't use it really that much when he was in Atlanta, and that's been a big part of the Falcons offense in the Dan Quinn era. So, you know, I don't see how that meshes. Like, it's just like the things that Dirk Cutter does don't really mesh at all with what the Falcons have done the last, you know, four seasons. Now, maybe some people will say that, well, that's a good thing, but I don't think it is. I don't think it's a coincidence that Matt Ryan has had three out of his four best seasons in the last 4 years. because I think he's playing in an offense that by design and back, you know, let's go back to early 2017 when everybody was insisting that Sark was going to be this, you know, awesome offensive coordinator because people weren't crazy when they were saying things like, well, the scheme is good. And so Sark, of course, Sark is going to be good because the scheme is good and the players are good. And it's like, yeah, those things aren't were true to a certain extent. It didn't automatically mean that Sark was going to, you know, come in and be great, as many people opine. But, you know, like the scheme and the talent is there that like it's really hard to suck with this scheme and with this talent. But then with Cutter, you're basically throwing away that scheme. You have talent, but like, I don't know. this move doesn't make any sense to me. So, you know, D-Led said, you know, the AJC, D-Led is the person who reported. I'll give you the exact quote before we move on. But it's like, Dirk Cutter has been offered the Falcons position of offensive coordinator. According to one person familiar with the situation, Cutter may have accepted the position late Monday. A high-ranking team official, when asked to confirm, would say only that there is no agreement at this time. So, I don't know. This move doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, if this is what the Falcons are doing. So we'll see if this gets confirmed. You know, no offense to D-Led, but he doesn't necessarily have a high hit rate of sort of breaking, you know, Falcons news. So I'm hoping that that streak continues, at least the streak of not breaking these sorts of things. And I hope that the Falcons are being patient and moving in another direction, because I don't want to go back to the Cutter offense. You're getting the second best offensive coordinator for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. You know, like, if this is what the, like, it doesn't make any sense to me. So I'm going to move on. I'm going to save my complaining and my negativity for a later date, but it doesn't make any sense to me. I've seen, like, this to me isn't, you know, some people will sit there and say like, oh, Aaron, you're always so negative about these things. But it's like, I watched the all 22 of the Dirk Cutter offers for 3 years. I was literally the only person watching the all 22 of those football teams. I know one other person that watched all 22 in 2014. That person currently lives in Australia, last time I checked. But it was like me and that dude were the only people watching the all 22. And this was not a good offense, guys. We thought it was at the time, but it really was a very limiting offense. This offense has a very low ceiling in this league. And it, to me, basically, unless Dirk Cutter has some new tricks that he's learned and has been saving in his back pocket over the last, you know, five seasons or whatever it's been, I just don't see this move. Just it's baffling to me. So, you know, I wasn't necessarily optimistic that the Falcons would make this great hire, but to basically turn the clock back to this antiquated, boring, vanilla offense that the Falcons operated in the Cutter years under Mike Smith just is baffling to me. So that's my thoughts. Hopefully, you know, we'll find some news where the Falcons come out Tuesday morning or whatever, being like, oh, there's nothing in agreement, that's fake news or whatever they need to say to make me happy. But man, this is, I don't understand it, but okay. I mean, okay. Like it's whatever. Anyway, let's move on. Let's talk about some of the top prospects in national championship. Let's finish this podcast by being positive about something. And speaking of national championships and postseasons, the NFL playoffs are here, and it's time for you guys to get in on the action with my bookie. Don't be that guy that's sitting around mad and upset. You got no rooting interest while your friends and family are watching the playoff games or watching Monday night's national championship game. It's that wonderful time of year for you to make some money. Make sure you're ready by signing up at MyBookie today. They pay fast when you win. They have great customer service. They have a great mobile site. Remember, where you bet is just as important as who you're betting on. And if you want to make money during this postseason, you got to go to MyBookie. I trust them, but you don't have to just take my word for it. Check them out for yourself if you haven't already. Join now. MyBookie will offer you a 50% deposit bonus and make sure you have a nice bankroll for January and February. Use the promo code LOCKEDON25 when you deposit to activate that offer. That's promo code LOCKEDON25. At MyBookie, you play, you win, you get paid. So let's talk about some of these prospects in this national title game. And as I said at the top, I was focused primarily on the trenches. We all were sitting there wowed by some of the throws that Tua made, particularly early in the game. Certainly Trevor Lawrence, those two guys, Tua's probably, I wouldn't say necessarily Tua's the favorite to be the number one pick in the 2020 draft, because he's not eligible for this year, neither is Lawrence. Lawrence won't be eligible till the 2021 draft. He's probably the odds-on favorite to be the number one pick then. You know, Tua's got to compete with guys like Justin Herbert and whatnot next year. But, you know, I think Tua's very likely to be a top five pick unless he's much shorter than we think he is. I don't know how short he is, but he seems like he's at least like 6'1", 6'2". So unless he comes in at like under 6 feet, which I don't think he is, he should be fine. But anyway, that's a conversation for next year. I'm sure I'll be talking with Mark Schofield about that, you know, 12 months from now. But anyway, so I was focused on the trenches. Let's start with the offensive line prospects. Primarily, this is Alabama. You know, Clemson has Mitch Hyatt, but he's okay. He's just a guy. Alabama has two high-level offensive line prospects, left tackle Jonah Williams, center Ross Pierschbacher. I don't know how to say his name. Jonah Williams is a guy that I think is in the mix for the Falcons' first-round pick. He had a pretty dominant performance against Cleveland Farrell 2 years ago in that national last year in that national championship game. I mean, not in the playoff game, not the national championship game, in the playoff game. And got his fair share of struggles against Cleveland Farrell this year. I thought Jonah Williams, I think the thing about Jonah Williams, and John Ledyard mentioned this on the podcast we did during the bye week when we talked some about some of the top prospects along the offensive and defensive lines with him. You know, John Ledyard, the co-host of the Locked On NFL Draft podcast. Check it out wherever you get your Locked On podcast. But I thought, you know, he said Jonah Williams was comparable to Jake Matthews, and I think that's a good comparison sort of for what Jonah Williams potentially is. The interesting thing about Jonah Williams, I don't think this game really improved his stock or really hurt his stock. I think his stock was always going to be made or broken by how he measures and tests at the combine, right? Because the big question about Jonah Williams, and you see people like Tony Pauline of DraftAnalyst.com talking about this, is some people think he projects better to a guard because he doesn't necessarily have the length and the size that teams want in left tackles. We know Isaiah Wynn was a 6'2" left tackle that the Patriots drafted, but that's a rare occurrence. Typically, teams want their left tackles, their offensive tackles, to be 6'4.5" or taller, to have a certain amount of arm length, typically I think like 32.5 to 33 inch arms at the minimum, depending on sort of their height. The taller they are, the shorter their arms can be, just because, you know, physics or whatever the case may be. But, you know, I think that's going to be the big question with Jonah Williams. The other thing with the Jake Matthews comparison is Jake Matthews was a very, very high level athlete. I don't think Jonah Williams is quite on the level as Jake Matthews, but I do think he's a better athlete than maybe some people give him credit for, but that will only be confirmed at the combine. So I think if Jonah Williams measures in shorter and without as much length as people think, I don't think he's just locked to be the first offensive tackle off the board. I think I wouldn't say he's going to fall out of the first round, but I do think he could fall into the second half of the first round. If the measurables aren't quite there, if the athleticism isn't quite there and people start talking about him being a guard, which is what you saw last year with Connor Williams, the offensive lineman from Texas who got drafted by the Cowboys in the second round, who went into the season by many people's standards as the number one offensive tackle in the league. If not number one, he was number two behind Mike McGlinchey, who wound up being the first tackle off the board. But like, I do think Jonah Williams could get sort of that treatment. And I don't think this game really helped him in that regard. I don't think this game really hurt him in that regard, because he's just been such a consistent player for the last 3 years that I don't think anybody's going to look at this game and be like, oh, he stinks. You know, you can go back and watch, you know, 40 some odd games and be like, oh, Jonah Williams is good. As for Pierschbacher, I think Pierschbacher is a solid zone blocking center slash guard. He played left guard, I think, last year and played center this year. I think he's a day three guy. I think he's a round five-ish guy. I don't think he's particularly special, but he's a solid position blocker. You know, he's one of those guys that I think has developmental potential as a center. I don't think he's necessarily a guy that you're going to draft and be like, oh, that guy can start for me day one and be an effective player. But I do think, you know, given a couple of years of development, he could be a solid mid-level starter, particularly in the type of blocking scheme that the Falcons utilize. But I don't think he's a major difference maker in that regard. But if, you know, the Falcons drafted him in round 5 or round 6 as sort of their guy that they're going to, you know, groom behind Alex Mack for the next year or two, and then with the intention of, oh, he's going to start in like 2021 or something like that, that, you know, that would be a decent draft pick for me in my eyes. So we'll come back in just a moment and talk about some of these outstanding defensive line prospects to wrap up the show. But since we're talking about the draft, you know, I say all these things, my opinions, you know, I say you should care about my opinions, but, you know, there are better people, there are more informed people, certainly, that will be talking about this game and some of the top performances that may conflict with some of the things I'm saying on tonight's show. And you definitely want to take those things to heart by checking out the two draft-related podcasts on the Locked On Podcast Network. First is the Locked On NFL Draft Podcast with the aforementioned John Ledyard and his co-host Trevor Sikkema. The second one is the Draft Dude Podcast with Kyle Krabs and Joe Marino hosting that show. Find them wherever you get your Locked On podcasts, as well as at thedraftnetwork.com, where you can find written and video content by those four guys, as well as several others. Again, that's thedraftnetwork.com, your team every day. So, you know, this game was chock full of potential first round defensive linemen. You have, in my opinion, two from Clemson. You have two probably from Alabama as well. Dexter Lawrence, the Clemson defensive tackle, who tested positive for some banned substance a couple of weeks ago, did not play in this game. I don't think Dexter Lawrence is a first round pick. He's a 340-pound powerful run plugging player, but those guys don't get drafted in the first round, and particularly guys like him who, you know, had whatever this issue is, in addition to the fact that he just is not a particularly productive pass rusher. You know, Vita Vea was at least a productive pass rusher, which is one of the reasons why he was drafted as high as he was, and certainly didn't necessarily live up to that until the last month of the season. But that's a conversation for another day. So the two guys from Clemson, Christian Wilkins, Cleveland Farrell, I've been, you know, outspoken with my belief that the Clemson defensive linemen have been overrated. I've been outspoken with my belief that Clemson defensive linemen often don't live up to their potential in the NFL. That has been pretty consistently true for about a decade. Grady Jarrett being an exception, DJ Reader, I guess, being a exception. Outside of that, you don't have a lot of guys that are sort of, you would look at and say, are home runs that, you know, hail from Clemson. Now, it's not simply because, oh, these guys went to Clemson, that means they're automatically overrated. I think those guys are overrated and they go to Clemson. So I think it's just continuing a narrative there. But I do think the thing about Christian Wilkins and Cleveland Farrell, Wilkins was a guy that was considered one of the top prospects a couple of years ago, like 2 years ago. And it was like, oh, he's a future top 15 pick. And then I watched him this past year, or not this past year, last year as a junior in 2017. And I was not impressed at all. And, you know, so I'm sure some people were like, how can you go from a top 15 pick to a guy that in my eyes was like a late second, early third round pick at best? And it's like, well, when guys are young, that's part of the issue with projecting players, is a lot of times when guys are young, people just tend to focus on the positives and the upside of a player and assume that all the blemishes and flaws in their game are going to get worked out by the time they're sophomores, juniors, and then eventually seniors. And that doesn't always happen. Like, you see that now with Trevor Lawrence. Everybody says, oh, this guy is a superstar. Trevor Lawrence made a lot of bad throws in that Clemson game. He made a lot of great throws in that game as well. But, like, people are willing to overlook the passes that, you know, went 6 feet above the wide receiver's head because they're looking at some of those great throws. But when we get to when Trevor Lawrence is a junior or whatever, those passes that are 6 feet over the wide receiver's head are going to be scrutinized a lot more than what they are now. So that's some of the reason why you can have these guys that are at one point really touted and then their draft stock falls and then, or it bounces. So it can fluctuate that way. But with Christian Wilkins, the thing you like about Christian Wilkins is he has experience playing across all across the defensive line, so he can play multiple techniques. I like him a little bit more as a one tech than a three tech. He plays a lot of three tech. He has a good first step. I don't really, like, he's disruptive, but I don't know. Like, I think he's better sort of facing up the center, where that's a more favorable matchup for him to win one-on-one, because I think he has a tendency to tend to have to rely on his first step to win in effort and motor, and that's all. Those are good things. I think right now, I think Christian Wilkins is a solid late first round pick. And again, going into the season, I saw him as like a late second, early third round guy based off of what I saw from him in 2017. So I think he's been one of the most improved players. He checks all the boxes from a character standpoint. So he's going to definitely win there. Like, I can definitely tell you, Mike Smith would have put this guy like top three on his draft board. we'll see what Dan Quinn does. And that's going to depend a lot on sort of how well he tests. He flashes athleticism, but I don't know if he's a great, great athlete. So I'm very curious to see how he tests. The same thing goes with Cleveland Farrell. I think Cleveland Farrell has all the tools you want in a top flight edge rusher. He has the size. He has the length. He has the first step quickness. My biggest knock on Cleveland Farrell is twofold. I don't think he bends the edge well. And you see this sometimes where he has a trouble to sort of, you know, dip the shoulder and pull that arc. And I think you'll see that reflected potentially in him not having a great three cone at the combine, but we'll have to see. And the other issue I have with Cleveland Farrell is I think he has a tendency to rely too much on his first step quickness and his speed and doesn't do a great job converting speed to power, despite thinking that he does have the tools to be this powerful player. The good thing he showed in his national championship game, you saw him use that power. He overwhelmed Jonah Williams on one play. I'm sure you can, if you go on Twitter or whatever, you can find the highlight of it. And I thought he did a better job disengaging and using his hands in this game than I've seen from him in the past. You know, my issue with him, he's always been sort of, to me, a one-note speed rusher that doesn't have quite the speed and bend to do that in the pros. So it's similar to Tack McKinley. Like, that to me is sort of the player he's always reminded me of. It's Tack, but he doesn't have Tack's power. He doesn't have Tack's bull rush quite yet. Maybe he can develop it in the league, but I maybe the Vic Beasley experience has made me skeptical about the ability to develop pass rushers at the next level. You know, some teams can do it. Danielle Hunter is a good example, but not everybody can do that. So I think Cleveland Farrell is a solid, you know, I am, based off of this performance, I am less averse to the Falcons, him being in the Falcons pick in the middle of the first round. I think that's kind of where his talent tops out, but people talk about him as a top five pick. I think he probably will be a top five pick unless he absolutely bombs the combine. I'm assuming he'll have a fast 40 and do some sick jumps. So in which basically if you're Dan Quinn, that's all you got to do really for him to love you. And if you got length, then, you know, you check all three boxes that he wants to see from an edge rusher. So he'll be in the conversation for the Falcons potentially. But I think he'll probably be a top 10 pick and when all is said and done. So probably not necessarily, you know, other than a couple of whispers in that conversation. Now switch gears to Alabama. I won't talk too much about Isaiah Buggs. I just haven't really focused on the Isaiah Buggs. I've been more focused on Quinnen Williams and Raekwon Davis. Isaiah Buggs is being projected as a day two guy. I probably should start watching more of Isaiah Buggs specifically because he is going to the Senior Bowl and he does at least fit the sort of initially pass a test of being maybe that sort of hybrid D-end interior rusher type of guy that could sort of take over the Derek Shelby role and be a little bit more effective as a pass rusher in that role. So I'll definitely go back and watch a little bit more of Isaiah Buggs because I haven't really done a lot of homework on sort of the day two D linemen and edge rushers in this class yet. And so he's certainly going to be on my list. So I'll try to get to him before the Senior Bowl kicks off. But the two main Alabama guys, the two guys that are probably going to be the first-round picks are Quinnen Williams, Raekwon Davis. Raekwon Davis, people knew about Raekwon Davis going into the season. Super strong, super powerful guy. I think the issue with Raekwon Davis, I think he's a 3-4 at the end. He's not really a pass rusher. You'll notice, or at least when I watch Alabama play this year and last year, they often would pull him off the field on third downs. Like, he's just not a pass rusher. He's really strong. Like, in, I'm going to say this name and people are going to be like, oh no, I don't want any part of that. But like, remember Rashid, I want you to remember the good Rashid Hageman, the Rashid Hageman that was bullying centers in the 2016 playoffs and down the stretch was looking like was actually being an effective pass rusher. I think the kind of hope for what Raekwon Davis will turn into is a player like that, but maybe with a little bit more technique, because Hageman had zero technique doing that. He was just bullying guys purely off of natural strength. I think Davis has that type of power and strength. So he's got a lot of upside, but I think he's a little raw at this point. And I think if you draft him, I think you should be a 3-4 team that's projecting him, hoping that one day he's going to turn into a Cam Hayward type of player for you. I think as a 4-3 player, I don't really like that fit there. I kind of think he's kind of miscast in that scheme. I want him basically two gapping. I want him holding the point of attack. I don't think he's really going to be this disruptive player, at least in the short term. Maybe long term if you can develop him. We'll wrap things up with Quinnen Williams. What is there to say? If you've been living under a rock for the last couple of months, Quinnen Williams is a guy that is a redshirt sophomore. He's expected to come out this year. He kind of came out of nowhere going into the season because no one really, he was a 4-star recruit or whatever. Played a little bit last year for the Alabama team. Was very productive in limited snaps last year, but because he didn't play so much, he wasn't necessarily on people's radar, and probably will be a top 3 pick depending on how the quarterbacks go at the top of the draft. But it's like Nick Bosa and Quinnen Williams, I think, are the clearly top 2 prospects in this draft class potentially. Bosa has declared. We'll see. I think you can make an argument that Josh Allen and Cleveland Farrell are probably potentially going to be the 3rd and 4th best guys from non-quarterback guys in this draft class potentially. So I think Quinnen Williams is a lock to be a top 5 pick. I think he's got a very good shot of being a top 3 pick when all is said and done. Going to a team like San Francisco or Oakland or something like that. So we'll see how that works out. But, there was a time when the Falcons had a potential top 5 pick and he was on the Falcons' radar, and he would have been, like a Bosa, a guy that I think people would have been, super enamored with and wanting the Falcons to trade up for. I've heard people say things like, he's the best D-tackle prospect since Ndamukong Suh. I don't think, normally I would be like, that's a hot take, but I think it's kind of true. Like, as far as, given how young he is, how well he uses hands, how powerful and explosive he is, imagining where he would be if he would stay in school for another year or two. I don't remember if Sue came out as a junior or senior. I think he came out as a senior. But imagining where Quinnen Williams would be, I do think he has that type of ability. And Sue was a generational. Him and Jerry McCoy came out in the same draft, and those two guys were generational defensive tackle prospects. And I think you can make an argument that Quinnen Williams has that type of ability and upside to be a generation D tackle prospect. So, unfortunately, the Falcons decided to win that Bucs game and lost, I think, 6 or 7 spots in the draft. And, had they lost that game, maybe in the position to at least trade up for Quinnen Williams or get another top-tier pass rusher like a Farrell or others in this draft class. But, Falcons got a Falcon. And so there you have it, guys. My Cutter rant, my thoughts on some of the top trench players in the national championship game. Definitely you want to check out Locked On NFL Draft Podcast and the Draft Dudes Podcast to get those guys' thoughts on some of the standout players. If you haven't been listening to those podcasts so far, certainly wanted to subscribe, because they're certainly going to be, for the next 4 months, they're going to be talking pretty exclusively about the draft for the most part. So you guys want to stay on top of all these things. All those guys are going to be down at the Senior Bowl, so they can give you firsthand thoughts on Isaiah Bugs, among other guys. So there you have it, guys. And we'll see if the Falcons and this Cutter thing is real. I hope it's not, as you can guess from listening to the first half of this episode. But we'll see how that goes, Okay. It is what it is, man. Until then, guys.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.